Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today in our last podcast of the year by Bradley Gerrard, news editor. How are you doing, Bradley?
I'm good. I've got a bit of a cold, so I'm sorry if I sound a bit funny to the listeners. I'll try not to cough directly in your ear.
Don't cough at me. Ian Smith, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you doing, John?
Not too bad. I haven't been here for a couple of weeks. Been handling it all brilliantly in my absence, I hear.
Yes.
Hey, good. No need for false modesty. Okay, right. So, last issue of the year, last podcast of the year. Actually, it's not the last issue of the year.
No, it's the penultimate, isn't it?
It is the penultimate. We have another issue coming out on the 30th of December, which I'll be working on next week. But it feels like the last issue of the year because it's the biggie that we do before we break up for Christmas.
It's a bumper with a Christmas jumper on the front.
It's a bumper issue with a Christmas jumper. It's a beautiful jumper. Where do I buy one? So, double issue, lots and lots of features looking at what we can expect in the year ahead from various asset classes, equities, European equities, American equities, bonds, property, the lot. But let's start with the news. We can't get the entire team in here to talk about this stuff, but I guess we can kind of summarize it as we talk through this week's news because most of it's related.
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, the big story in 7 days that came in the sort of middle of the day yesterday and chimes with the feature that I actually wrote about M&A. Basically, there's two potential bids for Punch Taverns.
And yeah.
Yeah.
And strange.
Yeah, it is strange. And Punch, like Enterprise, they're very, very similar businesses. They very much overextended themselves pre-credit crisis and were very much hit when the credit crisis, you know, struck.
Because they'd overextended themselves in terms of their estate.
Yeah. They were very highly indebted. They're sort of the credit boom. You know, they certainly sort of personified that. And so obviously when things went sour, they were really badly hit, had to sell off an awful lot of their estates. They're still selling off parts of their estate. I mean, Punch has still got about 400 pubs it wants to sell. And that's in spite of it already apparently finishing a strategic disposal program. So, you know, they're coming out of repair mode.
Still got lots of debt as well.
Yeah,
even though they've renegotiated that.
Yeah, a little bit securitized. So the kind of the attraction, I suppose, is that yes, they still have a lot of debt. Enterprise more so than Punch, but it is securitized against obviously an estate of properties, which is the value of which I believe I'm right in saying for both companies is greater than the amount of debt they have. That's the kind of the sort of the flaw, if you will, for the investment case. But the bids are interesting. One's come from Heineken, and one's come from a chap called Alan McIntosh, who is a Punch co-founder. Now, Heineken actually does own 1,100 pubs and bars in the UK already. I didn't know this.
I didn't know that
yesterday.
Either.
Their bid is slightly lower at 174p, and Mr. McIntosh's bid is at 185p. So I would suggest Punch is going to be bought. I mean, you've got two bidders potentially fighting it out. So, yeah, it's a very interesting development for a company that's been very hard push to get itself on the sort of straight and narrow post-credit crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. Could come as a relief to some long-suffering shareholders, I would imagine.
The stock rose about, when I was writing 7 days, it was up about 36, 37% yesterday.
Wow. Let's continue on the M&A theme, because towards the end of last week, we obviously had the Sky news.
Indeed, yeah. And again, that's been an interesting one because it was a bid that the Murdochs tried to make just before the phone hacking scandal kicked off. And what that ended up meaning was that the bid was so unpopular that actually it ended up not happening at all. So there's been a bit of a sort of 5 year or so, I guess, hiatus. And people who watch Sky and watch the stock, not just the TV, and watch 21st Century Fox as a business as well, the sort of, I guess, there was a bit of a suggestion something might happen when James Murdoch was put back on the board of Sky, which he had stepped down from previously. When he came back on last year, there was, you know, people in the market thinking, oh, okay, this is significant, this could mean something, and now here we are, it did mean something. It means that, you know, Fox is looking to buy Sky.
And this one looks like it's much more likely to happen than the previous attempts.
That's the kind of general view, yeah. I mean, there's less, well, depends on your point of view, but there's less immediate scandal, I guess, facing the newspaper part of Mr. Murdoch's empire.
It wasn't just the scandal, though, last time, right? It was the media plurality grounds of having, you know, one person or one group owning so much of the UK media landscape. So a big question is, how much has that media plurality issue changed? Now, at that point, I think that Murdoch offered to spin out Sky News, because Sky News, the independence of Sky News as a broadcaster, and obviously plays a great contribution in our popular media, is something that regulators care about dearly. So the question is, how much that media plurality angle changed? Now, the ownership of the business has actually changed. That's something that Theron gets into in his piece. So maybe that question has, do you think it's changed a little bit?
Well, yeah, and also what's interesting is that Sky recently bought the company that owns TalkSport. So there's a sort of, the concerns about media plurality obviously weren't there with that deal. So yeah, I mean, there does seem to be a bit more of, or a bit less, I should say, initial opposition to this bid. I think some people might like the price to be a little bit higher, but then that's probably always the case.
If it does go through, I mean, I wrote about kind of concentration in last week's issue, and it would be another example of that kind of vertical integration of businesses. Yes, they already owned a big stake, but if there's the creation of this kind of bigger business, total ownership of Sky, then it'd just be another example where, yes, you could probably make the media plurality argument because of some of the separate parts of the business, but you've created yet another kind of media giant. And what does that mean ultimately for the kind of, you know, the plurality of voices that we see in the public debate?
I think certainly, like, post Leveson, and with some more things coming out from that, and the people that were obviously very supportive of Leveson, I think, you know, you will hear a bit of a political outcry about this.
But Leveson was a flop ultimately. The recommendations haven't been taken forward. A lot of the different areas of the press, including Financial Times, have kind of gone in different ways in terms of the regulators that they've taken on. You could just make the argument that that case has been lost. I think it's more likely to go through this time. And I think because of the changes they've made within News Corporation or the wider group, and also because of, as you say, the unpopularity of the group is much lower at this point.
Yeah, big companies just keep getting bigger. They get their way in the end. I mean, actually, you know, talking of sort of the regulation of the communications sector, one of the stories that I noticed this week was the report that came out regarding the UK's mobile telephony infrastructure, basically saying that it was crap.
I have to say, I listened to a great thing on Radio 4 yesterday, where they had their technology correspondent in somewhere like Watford or something, like, stood still on a train platform, calling into the studio on using 4G, using Skype, I think it was. And they also had somebody on a moving train in Romania, and the line on the moving train in Romania was better than the one with somebody stood probably a couple of hundred miles away. It's remarkable.
I can well believe it. And, you know, my journey home, I think there's at least four, not short dead spots. You know, one of them is, you know, passed into Essex folklore, the Shenfield Cuts. You don't get a mobile signal for at least 3 minutes as you pass through that area. I mean, it is appalling. One could suggest that this is a result of consolidation, removing the imperative to invest in the infrastructure and the lack of regulatory oversight to make sure we keep up with our, you know, competitive nations.
Exactly right. And yeah, that again was one of the topics I got into in this piece, because one of the things that the consolidated businesses, these big giants that we have to deal with now, they promised a government infrastructure investment, but obviously they are not incentivized to, you know, invest in order to drive competition when they have more kind of quasi-monopolistic control over
which goes back
sector.
To the Openreach debate that was
exactly
going
right.
on the last couple of weeks.
So they offer just enough to try and keep the regulator off their back, and the jury's still out on that one, whether they've managed to kind of keep Openreach's cash flows within the business. But they've made just enough promises on infrastructure to keep the status quo in the interest of the company. But obviously, as an actual user of those businesses, the consumer doesn't stand to benefit from the high concentration in some of these industries.
I mean, it's quite interesting in light of some of the recent promises made by Philip Hammond at the Autumn Statement, you know, one of which was that there would be significant investment in the UK's digital infrastructure. You know, those sort of claims I always take with a pinch of salt, because it's not the government that will ultimately be responsible for delivering that infrastructure. It's companies like BT and Sky and Vodafone. Where's the incentive? Where's the pressure to make them do that? So, you know, it does beg the question, given that these are now kind of firm promises to help improve the nation's productivity, will more pressure be applied to improve this infrastructure?
It's hard to see what pressure can be applied that hasn't already been applied this year by MPs. So I could understand anyone's cynicism on that point. At the same time, I suppose we still have the prospect of the legal separation of Openreach from BT, just on that point. And also, there's speaking to people that work in competition consultancy, they say that there is the potential that they make it so difficult for BT to continue to run Openreach that it's really forced to just do a proper separation of Openreach, and that would introduce some more competition into that market. But yeah, when it comes to mobile data as well, yeah, it's hard to see exactly what pressure politicians can apply that hasn't already been applied, short of, you know, a more substantial kind of breaking up of the market.
So I heard someone speaking this week about the idea of UK roaming. So actually where you can actually flip between networks according to which is giving you the coverage you require. That might, you know, accelerate investment by some operators who are perhaps not as comprehensive in their coverage in some areas. You know, I mean, there are ways to perhaps do this. But hey, infrastructure, the bane of our lives, especially if you've been trying to get to work on Southern Rail this week. None of us have the pleasure.
No, thankfully, we're all okay. I think one person does use Southern, but they're getting in early and leaving early.
Yeah, it's a bit of a nightmare. My train company looks pretty brilliant in comparison, although it is, I understand, the fourth most complained about rail operator in the UK right now. Okay, what else have we got going on in the news? The Fed. Not in the magazine. We missed that. We didn't miss it. We couldn't write about it. The magazine had already gone to the printers.
But as expected, 25 basis points increase in the Fed's rate. But the bigger news was that they are now forecasting 3 rate rises of the same amount in 2017. And previously people had expected 2. So that obviously has had an impact in the market. We've seen the gold price come off a bit. It's a relative attractiveness of gold has been reduced, so the gold miners stocks have fallen. We've seen the yields in the government bond market increase, as you would expect them to do so, as is the intention. The big question is, how will the equity market over a longer period of time respond to this? Now, the last time they tried this in a year ago, the equity market ended up kind of falling out of bed. There are other problems out with it, but obviously the global economy at that point was not seen as resilient enough for them to kind of push through further interest rate rises. Now, this time round, the US economy is quite strong, and the Fed chair was quite keen to play down the impact of a Donald Trump presidency on this, but to talk about the strength of the US economy. But there is still the question of how this rate rise will impact on the global economy, and therefore whether they'll be able to pursue those rate rises that they've promised next year.
Indeed, I think it's a huge question. You know, I think a lot is being assumed about the direction of interest rates. And I really don't think we know all the answers. I mean, what we've kind of tried to do in our coverage is sort of suggest how these scenarios might play out and how you might want to manage your exposure to them. You know, bonds, there are ways of avoiding the potential worst impacts of these rises if you still want to hold bonds. It is interesting. A lot still up in the air, which is kind of the thrust of my editorial. I mean, you know, Trump is the Trump trade. It's sent markets through the roof. We really have no idea how much of what he's promised he'll be able to deliver, and you know, how that actually does translate into economic activity.
Yeah, and I think people have overestimated over the past couple of years where yields can get to, you know, how much upward pressure can be put on yields. And we keep talking about historic low gilt yields for a reason. Is that the market keeps kind of regressing to the mean in that respect. So it's going to be really interesting to see, yeah, which of his spending plans he's going to be able to get past his Republican colleagues who care passionately about the level of public spending. And obviously he's made lots of promises on kind of tax cuts, but also infrastructure spending, vast program. How much of that will he be able to push through? So although Ms. Yellen was trying to kind of downplay the Trump aspect, clearly that's all that everyone in the market is talking about. They clearly want to see what is going to happen and how that might impact. And the emerging markets today haven't, you know, started to slide just yet, but key will be the impact of kind of further interest rate rises on emerging market debt. Now, I in my piece for the Christmas feature looked at the beginning of this year, RBS put out a note, the rates team put out a note saying the bears have killed Goldilocks, sell everything. These are the things that are going to kind of collapse the global economy in 2016. Now, you can turn around and say, oh, they didn't come to pass. But actually, a lot of the things that they talked about as being very negative for the global economy, the amount of debt, the continuation of kind of easy money via quantitative easing, those things are still in the market now. So those, some of those threats that they talked about are still there, although obviously the commodities market has gone in a different way, and China, the China concerns that they had haven't progressed in the way that they have projected.
For now.
So, but there is a, you could almost write a similar note for 2017 if you wanted to be pessimistic about the ability of the global economy to reset itself in monetary terms.
Oh, but it does seem a bit like wishful thinking, a lot of what's happening in the markets at the moment, because yeah, I agree with the point about, you know, indebtedness. There is a huge amount of debt sloshing around the system, both personal debt and public debt
in every country. I mean, we had stats out from the Bank of England recently, didn't we? Record high credit card debt, I think it was, and you've got higher debt levels in the US, you've got very high debt levels in China, of which perhaps people aren't even really sure about where they are, you know. Actually, officially, you have figures, but there's a big problem with sort of dark lending and that sort of thing over there. So
absolutely. No, I think we ought to be circumspect in assessing what's really going to happen in respect of Trump's presidency next year and how that affects the markets. Anyway, lots of interpretation of that in the features this week. One thing we know Trump isn't a fan of, and that is the idea of climate change, which is something you've written about this week, Bradley, because this is something that's come out from the Bank of England, I understand it, and it seems that they are now flying in the face of a very strong lobby in America, which does not care one jot about the idea of climate change.
It's not just the Bank of England, although Mark Carney is very much involved. It's the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, which is part of the G20. Effectively, in a nutshell, they're saying that companies now are not properly forecasting or analysing, or if they are, they're not disclosing that, the impact on their businesses of climate change, and they need to.
Okay. Well, it's a nice idea. My personal view would be, how the hell do you forecast for climate change, given it's essentially unknowable?
One presumes that it is very difficult. However, you know, we do have obviously data about how much the world's you know, the temperatures have risen in past years. We have projections about how that might change, and obviously there are companies who will be let's take an insurance company, for instance. I mean, you know, global warming will have a very, very tangible impact on that type of business. An oil company, you know, there's this big move towards alternative fuel, so they need to be kind of in public letting us know what their plan is, and if they really think, or how they think that a move to, say, in an oil company's example, how a move to use of greater amount of alternative fuels will impact their business. So it's things like that.
I think the point is, it's less how, you know, global warming in total on a net basis will affect your company, and more how will the measures that the world has agreed to combat global warming, to keep it below a certain percentage,
has agreed to, but one of the biggest countries in the world is likely to ignore.
Yes, that's true, but the UK obviously is kind of signed up to this agreement,
but also decide it will ignore it when everyone else decides they're going to ignore it.
That is true of any international treaty. But at the same time, you have a responsibility to your shareholders, lawyers argue. And it was before this, we've had quite a lot of pressure from institutional shareholders and from kind of legal action groups. And I wrote about this earlier this year, to say, you need to say, this is just this is a financial risk now. It's not just kind of a bit of fluffy ESG, you know, environmental and social governance policy where you've got to kind of make some blasé statements in your annual report. It's actually saying, what is the financial impact on you, especially commodities companies, of not being able to get all of your stuff out of the ground because we have to, you know, reduce our carbon footprint as a country, or, you know, as a world. But yeah, it's more, what's the financial impact on you of those measures that have been agreed? But to your point, those measures might be rolled back. There's a lot of uncertainty at the moment.
I mean, it's not just that. I mean, you know, companies have a lot of reporting overheads on them already. You know, a company like, say, Shell, it's a huge business, actually, just managing its financials, managing the output, managing the communications to shareholders. And, you know, another layer, is it helpful? Does anyone actually read it?
Yeah.
You know, is it confusing the picture more?
Well, it'd be very important though, because if they're modelling that they have, you know, X well, Y well, and Z well, and they're going to produce, you know, X amount of oil, Y and Z amount of oil.
But in
20 years' time, we're not going to be able to pump the amount of oil they would be pumping in that year. Then that's obviously going to have a financial impact
but
on
my,
the company.
Okay, I'm playing devil's advocate. Is it their job to tell their investors what might be happening 20 years in the future under a certain set of circumstances which might change? You know, is that not a risk that's inherent in the business? And I'm pretty sure it's a risk they themselves do outline.
And in support of your point, Shell, for example, have said they kind of they don't buy into this stranded assets thesis. And if you actually look at the reserves that some of the major oil companies have, if you compare that to the amount of assets that Saudi Arabia has, it's a vastly bigger pool, literally. So actually, you can probably overstate the extent to which you kind of our listed oil players will have to, you know, leave some of those assets in the ground. But this is very much an area of live debate and something that Alex Newman, our commodities writer, has written about. But I think you can argue it both ways, but I do accept your point that if it's another 10 pages or 5 pages on an annual report that is already 100 pages, how much credence will be given to that by investors? How much of an impact will that have? And that the fallback of, well, it's got to be in the annual report and then you're covered, you know, is problematic. I think what investors need to do is to be pressuring both institutional and private shareholders is to be pressuring these companies on, okay, what are you, how are you affected by this kind of lower carbon world? But
yeah,
you think
absolutely.
That's basically impossible to do.
Well, no, I mean, funnily enough, one of the things I've been studying in my MA recently is climate change and the history of climate change and how we actually understand climate change and how we measure it and what affects it and how we kind of understand our vulnerabilities to it and how we respond to those vulnerabilities. And, you know, what's become increasingly clear to me whilst doing this is actually, despite the fact that our understanding of how the planet works and the weather systems work and whatnot is much more sophisticated than it was even 20 years ago, we still don't know all the answers. You know, there are the way that systems interact, like El Nino, for example. You know, what impact has that had on global temperatures in the past couple of years? You know, is that a temporary or a long-term effect? My point is that it's staggeringly complex. So to then boil that down into a set of kind of stock answers that a company is given to expect, it doesn't feel credible.
I think that's a perfectly logical argument, but I guess climate change is such a huge issue, and for companies, especially ones that are very involved in the amount of, you know, sort of emissions that we produce, you could argue that it would be a dereliction of duty if they're not to start considering this and at least trying in some way to inform shareholders about the, albeit potential and difficult to maybe sort of comprehend, but yeah, impacts on the businesses. There are lots of things businesses don't know about the future, like everything.
And,
you know, so, I mean, it's just another thing. You could argue, well, why bother? It's just another thing. But it is something, particularly with commodities companies, that's so inherent to their business models that, yeah, I think it will, you know, the pressure on them to do it, I think, will increase.
But my view is also that those companies, you know, in the oil and gas industries and the mining industries and, you know, power generation, they're not derelicting that duty already. You know, they are quite open with their shareholders in, you know, the climate-related pressures that they face.
Now?
Yeah. Well, that's the only ones they can address.
Yeah. And they are, I mean,
I mean, in the sense that they are open now about them. It's, you know, they've gone on a similar path to the kind of tobacco industry. It's like now they're very much accepting of the negative impacts.
I think they've been a lot quicker to respond than the tobacco industry was. I mean, you know, these are modern, it's a modern issue. It's a modern understanding that wasn't there, you know, 20, 30 years ago in the same way. Tobacco, you know, I mean, they knew for quite some time that I don't think they've been covering it up in the way that it's been proven that the tobacco industry certainly avoided actually facing up to some of the results of its products.
And also big oil companies are, you know, they are changing, they are looking at alternative fuels, they are investing in these. So a very simple thing like that, the amount more they're going to be investing in you know, alternative fuels in whatever financial year, that is effectively a tangible thing they can demonstrate to show how they're mitigating the potential effects of just relying on, you know, pure oil.
Yeah, indeed. Anyway, for now, buy oil. I mean, a big piece in the issue on commodities, actually following up on Alex's piece last week. But yeah, I mean, you know, been a great year for commodities after two terrible years, which just goes to show sometimes buy when there is blood on the streets. But yeah, something that we possibly expect to continue into the new year.
Yeah, I mean, we've been waiting for a year when the contrarian play on commodities would pay off, and some people thought it might be 2015. Well, it turned out it was 2016, and you could see that. I looked at the kind of total return figures across the FTSE All Share, and it looks like it's been a brilliant, absolutely brilliant year for the FTSE All Share compared to the historic average, the kind of real total return that you get from the equity market.
FTSE All Share, one year share price returns 15%. I mean, that pretty much makes it, with the exception of the Dow Jones, world's best market this year.
Yeah, it's done incredibly well. But within that, if you look at the constituents, it's been dragged higher by a set of outperformers that have outperformed the mean quite strongly. So I think it's about a third of companies outperformed the average, and some of them are bigger players that, because of the market capitalization effect, dragged that overall return higher. So the key being the miners. So they've had an absolutely brilliant year this year, and some of them, you know, are up kind of multiples of their value. So it's really been very strong if you've been in certain areas of the market. But some of our readers who aren't as heavily exposed to the commodities might look at that overall return and be like, well, what happened to me this year? Because there are some aspects of the economy, especially following the kind of fallout from the Brexit vote, that have suffered. Domestic banks, for example.
Domestic financials,
some of the kind of importer and retailers. And we've seen more of that in the results section this week. Some of the pressures on companies like Carpetright, Dixon's Carphone, Sports Direct.
Yeah, let's have a quick chat about some of those results. I mean, let's start with those retailers, because I think this is the week we've also released our retail podcast that Harriet Russell has put together.
Yes.
So, yeah, that, have a listen to that, because you'll get some of the sort of context and some of the pressures in aggregate that we think that sector's facing, and what companies are doing to respond to it. But now we've got some specific examples in the results section this week. I thought Dixon's Carphone's results sounded all right, but the shares didn't respond very well.
No, exactly right. That was very much a summation of our take on it. Obviously, the business that was outside of the UK did well, partly as a result of the declining pound against the euro and the Norwegian krona in a couple of their markets. But they do have this problem of the kind of not wanting to increase the prices for UK consumers. They're worried about the impact that will have. But in the UK and Ireland, electricals did well, white goods, consumer electronics, but there was lower computing revenue. But they are worried about the impact of domestic price rises. So there was actually quite a strongly worded cautionary statement, perhaps overly cautious, from the chief executive in the statement. So it might be that the market was responding to that caution, responding to the concerns about that imported inflation and how much the company will be able to pass that on. But yeah, we definitely saw that with Carpetright as well, and the high price of imported goods weighing on margins.
How long are we going to persist with this one?
Carpetright.
I don't like this company. I really don't like this company as an investment. I had it on. I was perma sell for me. And, you know, we're kind of banking on a recovery that's a refurbishment that seems to be an awful long time coming. But there were some signs, perhaps, that...
Yeah, I mean,
it might be happening.
It was attributed by the management. They had a rise after the end of the first half. So the first 6 weeks of the second half, like-for-like sales were up, but they actually fell over the first half. Now, that uptick, which is obviously, is a much smaller period,
yeah,
was attributed by management to the newly refurbished stores. Perhaps you should take that with some caution. But yeah, the shares currently are pretty much an all-time low in terms of the price-to-earnings ratio. At the moment, Harriet's continuing to back the fact that this refurbishment can get some underlying sales growth. But yeah, it doesn't look brilliant for a company that is, importing, relying on imported goods, which we know is already weighing on margins. So,
especially as well, when I cover a company called Victoria, which is carpets and floor coverings. And when I spoke to them a few weeks ago, the CEO, Jeff Wilding, was making the point that Victoria as a company imports a lot less raw materials than a lot of its competitors. So his suggestion, his claim about his company was that it might not have to implement the sort of amount or the size of price increases that rivals might do. So maybe Carpetright's also struggling against the rivals like that as well.
So good old-fashioned British carpet then.
Well, and that's how you see a resetting in the trade balance, right, of our country. I mean, you're seeing it in action through these companies, which I find really interesting, domestic carpet makers.
That's what we want, isn't it? I mean, this is the whole idea.
That's a political question, yeah. But I mean, it depends what you, yeah. But agnostic of whether it's what we want, that's the effect that it has, and it's quite interesting to see it's coming through. And obviously, you can see just in the 1 year share prices for some of these companies that those kind of importers have been hurt by that. Now, we'll have to see once that sterling has been kind of passed through over the year. That'll be really interesting to see how much they are managing to pass on to customers, whether they have the ability to do so, whether there's other kind of cost-cutting measures that they can take. But it's difficult. I mean, company like Sports Direct, we've just seen with JD Sports, the way that they try and economise has a real impact on the workers in their country, you know. And Sports Direct, one of the things that hurt it in its half-year results, where I think they kind of described it as investment in people, but that was very much remedying, you know, it's a kind of weasel words in some ways, because that was remedying many of the problems that we've seen with this company.
Yeah, JD's been sucked into this now as well, this whole warehousing staffing issue.
Yeah, so we've just had a statement from JD Sports today. It was a Channel 4 undercover investigation, very similar, stressing things like the amount of times that workers have to wait in queues, and then saying that effectively it looks like some of the workers were being paid below the statutory minimum wage because of the time they were spending in the queue. There was also the question of them having a kind of fire on the spot and a three strikes and you're out policy. Now, JD Sports has said we don't have those policies, so there's obviously a disconnect, but they are launching an investigation into that particular facility to see what's kind of going on there. But they've been presented with the full fact. I think this is going to be another theme if we're kind of summing up this year and looking at next year. I think companies, especially retailers' treatment of their workers is going to be very important on two things. I think one is on, yeah, their treatment of the factory workers within this country, and we've seen Sports Direct, JD Sports, I'm sure there'll be more, and how they deal with that. But another is the Modern Slavery Act that came into force this year, and companies looking at how they source labour from overseas. Now, some of the practices of those intermediaries in those markets that sort out the labour for our kind of garment sellers, some of their practices, the sharper practices, are now defined as kind of modern slavery. And it's something that I know the Prime Minister is reported to be quite passionate about, eradicating this. So I think you might see some pressure on companies around what's going on in the supply chain, as well as what's going on in their kind of, yeah, domestic operations.
Well, we did see this in the food industry a few years back when you had these gangmasters, you know, the old Winklers out in Morecambe Bay. And one of them, I think one of them was killed, weren't they? One of them was drowned, and kind of brought this into focus, and it's kind of disappeared again. But yeah, it will be, you know, omnipresent in many sectors of the UK.
What makes it very difficult for our readers is that, yeah, if something comes out about JD Sports, it looks very bad, the share price goes down. I don't know how the share price can be expected to price in whatever's going to happen to JD Sports as a result of this coming out. I mean, do you grade reputational damage? But it's quite hard to then make a call. Some people say that's a great buy signal, bad headlines, they'll sort it out, great reason to get into the stock. But we were just discussing earlier, there are other companies where, you know, that's been the tip of the iceberg, and then it's, you know, declined. Sports Direct's a good example.
But we kind of, pretty in our coverage, have kind of separated the kind of Sports Direct and its practices from a lot of the other retailers, and then you start seeing it creeping into the other retailers. You know, how far does it extend? Is any retailer free from these kind of practices? So, you know, you must start to worry about the whole sector.
Exactly.
And you know, this goes back to a bigger thing, I think. Is it just a retail thing that actually companies are going to face a lot more pressure to pay properly, to bring staff to the national living wage? We know that's affected staff in the hospitality industry. You know, all this pressure on companies to actually behave as they should, could have the effect of raising wages across the board, which has an inflationary effect more generally, which has an effect on eroding the profits of many of these companies. So actually, this kind of all sounds like good news for workers, but bad news generally for shareholders.
And there's a little side story to that, which is that there's a kind of review of the auto-enrolment pension reforms, and what most people in that industry have been trying to pressure companies to do is to pay people to up the statutory minimums when it comes to pension contributions. That's going to be really important, because if they up that, that could be a big impact on margins for businesses across the board as well.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's tricky times. Tricky times. We had a new new company. It's been on the market a little while now, but first results, Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah,
that share price looks good.
It does look good, doesn't it? Yeah, it listed in September, as it says on the tin, bowling.
I love bowling.
Do you?
No. I know a man who does, though. Hey, Dom, over the control room.
I do love bowling.
Go on, tell us.
A couple of years ago at All-Star Lanes in Brick Lane, I got the top score for the second quarter of the year, 272.
I think my top score in bowling is about 100.
If I hit three figures, I'm ecstatic.
I genuinely don't know what happened.
Did you have the rails up?
I did not.
Yeah, I think you had the rails.
I did not have the rails.
And I think
up.
You had that little device you roll the ball down at the beginning as well.
Yeah, I reckon you're right. Anyway, okay, so we're never having a bowling Christmas party or office party. Thank you, Dom. But anyway, Hollywood Bowl, people still bowl.
People still bowl.
I can't, it's unbelievable. I thought that was a fad when it came out, you know, sort of 30, 40 years ago.
It's still going. It's a relatively fragmented industry. I mean, Hollywood Bowl actually has a 33% market share in the UK. And I was speaking to the chief executive, Stephen Burns, and I asked him about sort of M&A and the prospects for it in the sector. And he said actually they bought a company called Bowlplex at the back end of last year. And that they bought 16 sites. They actually had to get rid of 6 because the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, became interested. So,
yeah, they're not interested in huge consolidation of telecoms industries, but
well, they are.
Sell those 6 bowling lanes.
Yeah, this is
they are interested in that. But yeah, I mean, basically, the point being that another big sort of deal in this sort of bowling sector is unlikely. Yes, there'll be the odd sort of single or sort of low single digit site acquisitions, but I think Hollywood Bowl is largely trying to grow through organic growth. It's investing in its sites, it's refurbishing them. Things like taking ownership of the food offering. I mean, I actually said to Mr. Burns that my memory as a kid is the food there was like a terrible sort of wimpy burger or something. And
no such thing as a terrible wimpy burger.
I beg your pardon, a terrible whatever burger. But anyway, they've brought the food offering in-house. They're in control of it. They're thinking that's quite an important thing. Investing more in the sort of amusement things that are in there as well. So
bistro bowling.
Potentially, yeah, exactly. So those sort of things are,
still won't get me in there, I have to say.
So those sorts of things are sort of organic drivers of the stock. I mean, we've left it on a hold for now. I think 18 times forward earnings sort of rates is a fair rating for the company. But yeah, we'll see how it does. As we said, it's a new one on the AIM market.
Yeah.
Sorry, a new one on the main market.
Main market, indeed. Let's talk about, while you're on the mic, Bradley, Fife. This is a tip of the year come good. Not this year, the year before.
Prior years. My predecessor, Julia Bradshaw, tips this on the prospects of it potentially being a takeover target. And my time writing about it actually has been many of the stories have involved Fife taking over something else, most recently mushroom companies in Canada. But yeah, Fife has now become a target of a takeover bid. It's an all-cash offer, and it's, from memory, it's a 49% premium to the share price prior to the news of the takeover being on the horizon. So we've sort of suggested that it's worth taking this. It seems like a very good deal, even though the sort of Fife business looked very healthy in itself. It was making acquisitions, diversifying from fruit into vegetables. Good company. But yeah, the deal does look chunky, and as you can see from the tip update piece there, the share price change since our tip, I think that is up 137%. So
not bad. We do get them right from time to time. We're actually working on tips of the year now for the first issue of next year, which I think is it's the first week of January. Yep. Can't remember the date. It's the same format. There'll be takeover tips, ideas, and such alike. Let's hope we pick a good one in that segment again.
I'm actually writing it, so
the take. All right,
yeah. Well, obviously not going to say it is.
Say no more.
But, yeah.
Well, you can't go wrong at the moment. Everything's being taken over. We've got E2V on the same page here, which is being taken over.
I hope I don't live to regret that phrase. Can't go wrong.
Yeah, it's not often said on stock markets, is it? Okay, so we've barely scratched the surface of this 104-page magazine. But we've run out of time. Lots more in the magazine this week. Algie Hall has reviewed his stock screens for the year to see how he's gone. It's been a difficult year, actually, for mechanical strategies. But that is the nature of the game. Sex Focus, which you've written as well, Bradley. Food.
I did.
Food fads. All good companies, these, actually. I've always liked this sector.
It's really interesting. There's a lot of the consumer sort of desire for free from ingredients or healthy foods, but tasting the same, that being the important thing, is a growing thing. And there are lots of companies, as I mentioned in my sector focus piece, who are poised to benefit from that.
Yeah, I mentioned Glanbia, which I always liked. That's muscle building powder.
Yeah, it's more focused on like protein based exercise and not exercise enhancing, diet enhancing.
But Kerry Tate and Lyle, I mean, moving, and Pure Circle moving. In fact, Kerry Tate and Lyle have moved from commodity businesses to focus on these ingredients.
Indeed.
Pure Circle is an ingredients business. Yep. So, no, I think it's a fascinating sector and well timed for Christmas as we go away and stuff ourselves with all sorts of unhealthy goodies.
Exactly.
As I say, 40 pages of features. I'm not even going to go into them. Oh, yeah, we've got an exclusive as well, Bradley is reminding me, on a recent, another takeover, Sierra Rutile, where it seems the FCA, we discovered, is scrutinising some trades in that miner just before the deal was reconfirmed. It's a bit of a strange one, this.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts to the story, so I wanted to sort of flag it on the podcast so people are aware of it. But yeah, it's definitely worth a read. There's some great work by Alex Newman there.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots of comment, four pages from Simon on his small cap strategies and views for the year ahead. A double page spread from Bearble at his gloomiest. And obviously lots in the personal finance and funds section, as well as everything they produce for the main features, which they will be talking about tomorrow, I presume, on their podcast. Anyway, thank you very much. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Ian. Got any nice plans for Christmas?
Going down to Devon.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I'll be in Kent, not quite as beautiful as Devon.
And I'll be in Essex, which is the most beautiful of the lot. So anyway, thank you all for listening throughout the year. Thank you for reading the magazine. This one will be on sale for 2 weeks, as I say, £5.95 in all good newsagents. Invest in style. Other than that, all I have to say is Merry Christmas to all of you. Have a wonderful holiday, and we'll be back in the new year.